I'm Alex.
And I'm Matt, and welcome back to the show. Our guest this week is Will McCants, a fellow in the Center for Middle East Policy and director of the Project on U.S. Relations with the Islamic World at the Brookings Institution. He is also an adjunct faculty member at Johns Hopkins University and has served in government and think tank positions related to Islam, the Middle East, and terrorism, including as State Department Senior Advisor for Countering Violent Extremism. He is the author of Founding Gods, Inventing Nations, Conquests and Culture Myths from Antiquity to Islam, and the forthcoming The ISIS Apocalypse, The History, Strategy, and Doomsday Vision of the Islamic State.
So Matt, what have you been up to the summer now that we're back for season two of Sources and
Methods?
Yes,
we're back, season two. It's been a good summer, very productive, the vast majority of which has been spent right here in Gaziantep, where I'm calling you from. Still very much with our research center here, SREO, SREO, which is kind of taking a hard, independent, data-driven look at what's happening in Syria and providing, you know, M&E for NGOs and all that kind of stuff. So really kind of sinking my teeth into as much of northern Syria as I can, Arabic study, of course, paired with that, the Syrian dialect, and a good amount of writing, you know, around the internet, papers and whatnot. What about you?
I was in California for the Middlebury Arabic 8-week program.
Excellent.
Kind of, isolated off there. And for people who are curious about that and who want to read more than they probably want to, on kind of language self-study general things relating to the study of Arabic, check out, I wrote a kind of long blog post recently as to the kind
it's
of
tools
and things that that I use, and I'm kind of working on something on how to get out of plateaus in language learning, particularly with reference to Arabic. So that should hit soon, my blog.
Mm-hmm. And you know, we've devotees of the show, I'm sure we'll have by this point probably heard about you know, you were in the press recently for one of your projects around the Taliban sources. What's happening there?
Yes, unfortunately, you know, the project which I've been working on with my two colleagues, Felix Kuhn and Anand Gopal. We had collected while we were working in Afghanistan a whole bunch of documents, the world's largest archive of Taliban documents, as we like to call it.
Mm-hmm.
We've been working together with a number of partners to kind of translate and digitize all of this. I've been kind of busy with that for the past 2 years, recently we were rejected by the British Library, who'd been a kind of institutional partner since the beginning of the project. The British Library turned us down and said that they probably couldn't host the digital collection of the project as we had originally thought they would, on account of the counterterrorism laws in the UK. Disappointing, but you know, the kind of light at the end of the tunnel is,
yes, exactly,
as a result of that article, and in fact since that kind of refusal by the British Library, we've had a lot of interest, and now we're kind of building a coalition of we've had a lot of interest from universities, think tanks, libraries, institutions around the world, including a lot in the US, which I wasn't really expecting. It seems we should be fine in terms of the hosting of the projects. Just the UK seems like it'll lose out.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, incredible. But I'm glad there's some good news coming down the pipeline there. You know, the Americans can step up and do something
right
here.
Yeah.
Show up the Brits. It's not so bad.
The show today, we have a great guest for our first episode of the new season. We spoke to Will, as we just said, about his new book, about ISIS, about working with difficult sort of vanishing sources in other languages. We talked about the value of academia. We talked about policy work, particularly anyone who wants to get into that, I think will find today's podcast extremely interesting. We'd also like to thank Tinderbox for sponsoring Sources and Methods. There will be, halfway through this episode, a short clip, as in the last episode, explaining Tinderbox with a short interview with me. And I hope you will check out Tinderbox by going to eastgate.com/Tinderbox. And of course, links will be available in at the Sources and Methods site.
And without further ado, here's the show. I'd like to talk to you about the importance of policy papers and their impact on government, if any. You know, many researchers, academics, journalists, etc., indicate that a lot of what they're writing and the purpose of and the goal of what they're writing is to, you know, quote unquote, influence the policy discussion, however lofty that may be. And as somebody who has served or is serving very prominently in the policy debate, I think a lot of people are paying attention to what you're writing about ISIS and with your former work with the State Department. Actually, I was just curious, you know, what is the use and importance of these policy papers to people in government? New ones seem to emerge daily on all kinds of topics. I mean, can you actually influence the policy makers with a paper like your Brookings one, which we'll get into in a little bit?
I'm convinced that every single policy paper I write is deeply influential, and the government is taking note of every pearl of wisdom that I dispense. No, I mean, what you learn working inside a government is that you don't have a lot of time to read any of the policy papers.
Right. Is that why they're all one page long?
Well, that's why they all have the executive summary.
Right.
Because that's
right,
about what you have time to read. But, you know, the policy papers, what they do is they mark you as a person who has expertise on a particular subject and a certain point of view on that subject. So you become identified with a topic and a way of approaching it. And then, you know, that is useful then as a calling card. But if you really want to influence policymakers, I think few things are more influential than the op-ed. Anytime you can place something in a major newspaper, that will have a lot of influence. And sadly, the more critical you are of current policy, the more circulation your op-ed will get inside a government
building.
Right? Well, because government workers, they're very and policymakers, you know, the not well kept secret is that, you know, they're very conflicted about their policies, and there's different constituencies and got inside a government who are either in favor of the current policy or want to change it. So the more critical an op-ed is of a current policy, the more circulation it gets inside the building, because they're, you know, they're self-flagellating, and, you know, they worry that they've got it wrong. And if someone's critical of the current policy, oh, what are my bosses going to think of this? Or the constituent inside the building that wants to push for change will hold the op-ed up as evidence that they were right all along and the current policy is trash. So the more critical you are, the more circulation it's going to have. And it's not necessarily because you've said anything brilliant, but rather that there is a constituency for change already inside the government that will take your piece as an external validator of what they would like to do.
Do you think all of this is kind of is a healthy way about to go about things? And if not, how would that change, do you think?
I don't know how it could be any otherwise. I mean, it's not the greatest way to make policy, but, you know, I'm mindful of the fact that people inside government don't have a lot of time to do deep reading. They have an insane amount of issues that they are juggling. You know, we on the outside will have our one pet issue, but the person inside government who's in charge of that issue also has 20 others.
Right.
So their attention span is very short by the nature of the work and the fewness of the human resources to tackle it. And the only way you can get their attention really is by having something that gets a lot of attention in the press, because for the reasons I mentioned, but also because it gets the attention of Congress. And of course, Congress in this country holds the purse strings. So if you want to influence government policy, the op-ed is really the way to do it. The policy paper is good. I mean, it helps you as a researcher think through a policy problem and come to a position. And as I said, it also serves as a calling card. But you know, those policy papers aren't being read deeply inside a government.
Mm-hmm. With your with that in mind, was there a certain rubric kind of beyond the op-ed pages that led you to kind of selecting a group of individuals that you would listen to on a particular subject?
No, I mean, I was a little bit different because I came in with my own expertise. So I already knew the lay of the land outside. You know, I knew the scholarly community or the analysts working on my subject. So I was a little bit different from other people inside of government. And, you know, usually what they will do is they will select the few big names that appear in the press. So, for example, in the previous decade, when it was counterterrorism, it was always Mark Sageman, right? Mark Sageman would be invited to everything.
Right.
And, you know, his stuff was circulated a lot inside of government. I think one of the things I saw at the State Department, especially when I left, was an effort to get newer researchers, younger researchers. And so you saw many more of the names we would be familiar with, but a lot of outsiders aren't, getting invited to give talks at the State Department, which I thought was really healthy because the younger researchers tend to be closer to the field work and their findings are a bit more fresh. So, you know, you complement the more seasoned researchers with the younger ones. I think you get a good balance.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So what you're saying is that at the end of the day, sort of despite these limitations around time, despite, you know, kind of all of us and our limited mental bandwidth, you know, if you produce these papers and become recognized as an expert on a certain area, you know, you could end up inevitably having a fairly serious impact on policy being kind of via these continued invitations over to, say, the State Department or elsewhere?
Absolutely. And, you know, for the researcher, the benefit is you will get a sense of what the government is working on and what their
right.
questions are, which aren't always our questions. Mm-hmm. And I think, you know, for the outside researcher who's never been in government, it helps to do a little bit of government service only because it gives you a bit more humility about what you know versus what the government knows. You know, I was really struck when I went into the State Department and started reading the intelligence from Afghanistan and Pakistan, just how detailed the intelligence was and how much more severe a certain problem was than I thought, just by reading outside press reports. And it's almost as if you're really having two different conversations, you know, and they're mm-hmm. both conversations are very helpful and useful to have. But I think as researchers, you know, we forget sometimes that the government in many instances is playing with a different set of information. And we get upset at a certain policy or a certain way of thinking. And rarely do we pause and take into consideration the fact that, you know, they may see it differently because they're looking at a different set of facts than we are. So working in government, I think, gives you a little bit more humility about, you know, one's own research and where it fits into this big decision-making process that's the U.S. government.
You just used the word seeing it differently, which I love. I'm wondering, what is the role of politics in all of this? I mean, it's kind of the elephant in the room or the backdrop in front of which all of this takes place, particularly if Congress has the purse strings, as you say. You know, does it happen or have you experienced this where, you know, sound policy is developed, you know, calm, formal, sober, realistic, and gets kind of, I don't mean to just play into a stereotype, but, you know, gets seriously challenged or maybe even ignored because of, you know, the politics, domestic politics or foreign politics of the day. And does that serve as kind of something that everybody should bear in mind as they're developing, you know, these policy papers?
Oh, sure. Sure, it has an impact. And why wouldn't it? I mean, our leaders are elected by, you know, the American people, and their foremost desire is to get back into office. So they domestic politics is always uppermost in their mind, and I don't think we should be surprised otherwise. And what may make for terrible foreign policy makes good sense for domestic policy. And, you know, I'm a little bit neutral on the question just because I can appreciate why, you know, our leaders would, you know, and given our system would be so keen on keeping an eye towards domestic politics. I think it happens for two reasons. One is what you mentioned with Congress, but also, you know, at the very high level of the president and his handful of advisors, you know, that's where the considerations are most political, and many sensitive foreign policy questions are concentrated in the president's hands. So you could have your bureaucracy at state, DOD, other places come up with policy formulations. They get all the way up to the junior staff on the National Security Council, which would be equally neutral and thinking about the foreign policy alone. But then once it gets to the president's desk, he has to think about domestic politics, as he should. And sometimes a good foreign policy, you know, just would not make sense in terms of domestic politics. But a lot of the decision making in this administration and in some of the more recent administrations, you know, a lot of it is concentrated in the handful of people, literally just a handful around the president.
There's this truism, I guess, or often gets said that the U.S. government, or even to some extent kind of European governments as well, can only focus on one big thing at a time. And, you know, we saw for several years it was Afghanistan, and all of the conferences and all of the discussion was about Afghanistan, to some extent Pakistan. And now, to some extent, despite things being said about, you know, pivot to the east and so on, it seems the Middle East is once again kind of consuming people's attention. Do you see that to be the case, or do you think there's more capacity than that?
No, I think that's about right. I think the crisis of the day, whatever it is, in the media will certainly be the crisis of the day for the president and the people around him. The problem is they can't give their sole attention to it, right?
Right.
If they could give their sole attention to a single crisis, that would be better. But, you know, they've got the crisis of the day they have to solve. So that takes 90% of their time. But then they've got all these other crises bubbling along that they also have to manage, which means it's difficult to come to a satisfactory policy on any of them simply because your attention is constantly being drawn away.
But I mean, presumably that's why you have billions of dollars and large staffs and so on. I mean, to play devil's advocate here. I mean,
yeah, sure. And you know, people that haven't worked in the U.S. government, they should know that it is vast. I mean, foreigners that are come over and work in the U.S. government. They're seconded. Like I've worked with a couple of Brits and Australians in DOD, State Department. They are always, to a person, astounded by the size of the American bureaucracy, the government bureaucracy. It is huge. And right, in an ideal world, that whole executive branch machine would be humming along, generating policy options for their principals to consider and bring before the president. But that's not really how it works in practice. I mean, they do generate those policy options, but really, it's the president and the few people around him that are deliberating on these things. And if they find a policy that suits their preconception or a policy that they already want, then they'll select it. But I don't think, my impression having been in the government was that, you know, the way it's supposed to work, where policy options go up and they are considered, that's not how it works in practice.
Right. There's also sometimes I kind of feel a comparison game going along to some extent where, you know, you'll have one organization pop up and it'll be like the worst organization of the day, and everyone wants to get rid of it or deal with it, let's say. And then, you know, a few years later, there'll be something comes up that'll be slightly worse, and this is the organization we really need to tackle. And then you know, you have a few years pass, and there's a new organization. Let's say ISIS is that organization at the moment. And then, you know, everything else gets kind of reconfigured to so the previous organizations actually aren't so bad in comparison. So, you know, we really need to rethink policy. Do you see that kind of thing going on?
Yeah, and not all of that is, you know, entirely the administration's fault. You know, some of that is, you know, the people that they are dealing with. You know, the fact that these movements, these violent movements, are splintering and becoming worse, you know, means that the metrics for what's good and bad shifts. I mean, Al-Qaeda used to be the baddest of the bad for years. And then the Islamic State, which was always bad, but has now developed serious capabilities and puts, you know, under threat U.S. interests in the Middle East. Now it occupies all of the attention. You know, the reality is the Islamic State presents far less of a threat to the homeland than it does to our partners in the region. And I think they understand that at right. The president's level. I mean, if you look at the way he justified the bombings against the Islamic State in Iraq and then in Syria, it was about the threat to our regional allies. But I don't think popularly, that's the perception in this country. And also, I think from Congress, there is a feeling that, you know, the Islamic State is going to launch waves of human attacks every day. And that's just not the case.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Wondering if we could go back to just a larger thematic question. How did you decide to get involved in the policy game to start with? Was there a triggering moment in your own research or field experience or work, and we'll get into more of your work in the next section. But was there a moment where you said, you know, I think I really need to take to trying my hand at the policy debate, which, you know, put you all the way into advising policy right at the where it's made?
Yeah, I mean, 9/11 was that moment. I was in graduate school at Princeton. It was my second year of a PhD program. I was working on early Islamic history, you know, when they smashed the planes into the towers, I wanted to contribute intellectually to the American response. I mean, most of the field people in my field of study wanted to have nothing to do with the U.S. government, felt like the U.S. government was reaping what it had sowed for years. My response was, you know, even if I disagree with U.S. policy, I would like to contribute to making it right. or at least better informed.
Right.
So I went to one of my professors, who was the only guy I knew who was working on jihadism, which was Michael Duran, who was a professor at Princeton at that time.
Yep.
And, you know, I asked him, like, I want to contribute. What can I do? And he happened to have found a Al-Qaeda strategy manual called The Management of Savagery. And he asked me if I was interested in translating it. So I said, yeah. So that was my first foray into jihadism, was translating that book.
Amazing. We're going to get into that again. But since you just mentioned your work on a PhD, you know, we have a standing policy here on this show to ask everybody who has a PhD, whether it is worth getting a PhD. what's your take on that?
But I absolutely, but I'm totally biased, right? Because it's worked out for me really well. You know, I would say if you're getting the PhD because you believe you're going to get an academic job, that is would be a terrible decision, right? You will probably not get an academic job. And if you do, it's probably not going to be at an institution or a geographical location, where you want to be. And so if you go into it with that limited, perspective, I think you're going to be very unhappy. But if you go into it with the perspective of, I want to get some great training and study with amazing people, and the world is my oyster, I can do anything with this PhD, I think it's a great thing to do and time well spent.
We'll take that as an endorsement then. just switching over to your upcoming book, neither Matt nor I have read it, but obviously we've been following the work that you've been doing, and you know, I've been, I think we initially connected over Twitter a few years ago, so we've kind of been reading through since then. In the kind of publicity material relating to your book, it talks a lot about kind of the use of new sources. I'm kind of interested if you could talk a little bit about that, about the kind of sources that went into your to the book, and what kind of key takeaways you've come away with.
Right. So a lot of them are the Al-Qaeda, the private Al-Qaeda memos that have been released over the years, which are not technically new, but they're new to most outsiders.
Yep.
Even scholars of jihadism have not, in most cases, read that corpus.
Yep.
So there's still a lot of very fresh, interesting material in there. So that is a major source, was just putting all of it together to tell the story about the relationship between Al-Qaeda and the Islamic State. Some of the newer stuff are testimonies that have come out from ex-members of the Islamic State, going all the way back to 2007, but also more recently, where they come out and they're airing dirty laundry. And these are, you know, this is probably the only way to get real insight into some of the tensions in the Islamic State organization and how it actually functions. I mean, aside from the memos, you can't really get a good sense of the bureaucratic politics and the cutthroat culture in an organization like the Islamic State unless you have defectors telling their story. And of course, you have to use those sources carefully, right? Because they have an axe to grind. So you have to weigh it against other kinds of information and put a lot of caveats on it. But nonetheless, it's an important part of the story. I think a third source have been all of the administrative documents that are coming out from the Islamic State. You know, you've got documents pertaining to price controls in Raqqa, the prices for slave girls being sold in Mosul, all of these administrative documents that give us a better sense for how the Islamic State actually functions in the world. Are being either circulated by supporters of the Islamic State or angry people living under Islamic State rule who want the truth to be known to the broader world. So there's a rich mine of this kind of material that's appeared on Twitter and on Facebook that's really useful. And then, you know, the fourth source would be just the amazing reporting that's been done in Arabic about the group.
Yep.
You know, the Arab reporters have amazing sources. They are fearless. But a lot of times, you know, the things that they report don't make it into Western media. So there's a valuable gold mine there of information to be used.
Is there anyone in particular that you think are worth following and keeping up to in terms of people who are continuing to write stories these days?
Well, I mean, when I was working on the Baghdadi biography, I remember I came across one source that was just fantastic because he had talked to a bunch of close friends of Baghdadi and also members of the former Islamic State. And his name, I think, I don't want to get it wrong, it's Ali al-Hashimi, I think. Fantastic work. And he had these guys on camera. He had transcripts of it. And it was a really valuable treasure trove of information that you couldn't find anywhere else. But also, I would say there's great work happening in some European languages, right? That we're not getting access to in English. So there's some German documentarians who went to Iraq and said, "Hey, Iraqi government, can we get Baghdadi's government records?" Sure. Here you go.
Right.
So they have an amazing amount of government documents that help us ground his biography in some facts when there's so much rumor swirling around him. It's was really useful to help me create a chronology of Baghdadi. But you know, all of their reporting had been done in German, none in English.
This episode of the podcast is sponsored by Tinderbox, a personal content assistant that helps you visualize, analyze, and share your notes.
I'm Alex Strick. I'm a writer and a researcher. I write books so far mainly about kind of history of South Asia and working together with Afghan actors of various sorts to kind of tell their stories or kind of transmit their works to other languages. Every book or research project, in fact, that I've worked on, particularly the big ones, they've all started off or initially been kind of mapped out in Tinderbox.
Tinderbox has become a central part of Alex's note-taking workflow.
It's kind of been my go-to place for notes of various kinds. If I'm ever starting a project or if I'm ever, even if I just want to kind of think through an idea to myself, I will often start out just simply by kind of opening up a fresh Tinderbox document. One of the great things about it is that it allows you to view your notes and the kind of scattered thoughts that you have in a variety of different ways. As your needs expand, Tinderbox will almost certainly expand with it in terms of the features which are already there. And it's, you know, it's an actively developed product.
There are countless ways in which a tool like Tinderbox can help journalists, students, and researchers.
Every time you go back to starting a big project, let's say, which has slightly different needs or requirements, you suddenly discover that, oh, Tinderbox could do this as well. You know, I've used Tinderbox, like I said, as just a pure note-taking tool. I've used it as a database software to track the kind of ISAF night raids, kill and capture campaign, tracking, you know, press releases and numbers of dead and wounded, which was then kind of used on the Guardian's data blog as kind of a big data project. I've used it to map out relationships between Mujahideen and kind of Islamist leaders, thought leaders, and the interactions between them. I've used it to, like I said, organize books and notes.
Check out the link in the show notes to see all the features Tinderbox has to offer and to download a free trial. The best way to see what it can do for you is to download the trial and start taking notes. Thanks to Tinderbox for their support.
Your book focuses on one aspect of the Islamic State that at least doesn't make it into the discourse on the group, at least on a daily level. And, you know, it's right in the title of your book, Doomsday and the Apocalypse. These are issues that I think would be of a lot of interest to people in the West, as one of their recruiting tools and something that seemingly worked very effective is their references to historical events. How important is that concept to the American Western discourse on the Islamic State?
Well, I think it's really important in terms of attracting foreign fighters. You know, if you from the West, if you think about what gets a foreigner motivated to leave their home and travel to an insanely violent conflict zone, there are a few things that might motivate people more than the belief that the end times are right around the corner. So I see a lot of that apocalyptic propaganda from the Islamic State really directed towards foreign fighters. But also, you know, in the Middle East, after the Iraq War in 2003, apocalypticism began to get a lot more currency than it used to have. You know, before the war, apocalypticism among Sunnis was, you know, really kind of a fringe subject as compared to the Shia, for whom it's, you know, been an important topic for centuries. For modern Sunnis, they kind of look down on it as, well, that's something that the Shia speculate on, but that's not really our bag. The U.S. invasion of Iraq really changed the ways that Sunnis thought about the end times. And then with the Arab Spring coming and all the political turmoil that's followed in its wake, it's given an apocalyptic framework far more currency than it ever had as a way to explain political upheaval in the region.
Just to kind of switch over to the recent profile, which I think Brookings co-published with The Believer, if I'm referring to that in the right way.
Yes, right.
You know, this is a heavily kind of it's a profile, right? So you're going through his life story and showing how this intersects and interacts with the history of the Islamic State and other groups in Iraq and the wider region. You know, there are two kind of broad strands of thinking that we might, in terms of kind of how history is written, we might talk about person driven history and kind of more abstracted forces driven history, where the actions of people actually aren't so significant. So I guess the kind of big question I'd like you to kind of talk to, particularly maybe in reference to your profile, is history made by men or by these faceless forces?
You know, I think my perspective on this changed when I went into government work, and also just went to work in general. You know, I think if your workaday world and your professional experience is going up through graduate school and then getting a position in university, I think you tend to prefer explanations of the world that look at things in terms of big, you know, structural forces that are beyond the capability of one human to control.
Right.
When you go into a big bureaucracy like the U.S. government, and then you look at, and then you have actually a series of good bosses or bad bosses, and their competency as bosses really has an influence on how policies are made. Not just the substance of the policy, but how it moves around the building, whose attention it gets. Come away with a much greater appreciation for how much individual humans matter in a big faceless organization like the Department of Defense or the State Department. And, you know, when I was working on the Baghdadi profile, I had in mind a lot of my own experience in government bureaucracy and how cutthroat it can be,
right,
how complicated it is. So I had a much greater appreciation for the role of individuals. And I think if you were to look at the landscape of the civil war in Syria and Iraq, you can see a lot of different personalities and leaders in many different groups. But what's fascinating is they are all responding to the same circumstances, i.e. the civil war, but in very different ways, right? They're making different choices.
Yeah.
And some of that has to do with their organizational culture, and some of it has to do with the temperament of the individual. And even within the Islamic State, if you compare the current Baghdadi to his predecessor, or the real shadow ruler of the first Islamic State, Abu Ayyub al-Masri,
yeah,
the current Baghdadi is just a much more capable bureaucrat,
yep,
than those men were. And they paid the price for their incompetency, and he has been rewarded for his competency. So, you know, individuals definitely matter.
Right. How far do you think we are in constructing a profile of the ideology behind things like Salafi jihadism and the kind of related strands to that? My sense is that we're only still starting to scratch the surface, but a lot of people disagree with that. Where do you stand on that?
I'd be interested to know why you think we're just scratching the surface. I haven't thought about it, so I don't necessarily disagree, but I'm curious as to why you think we've just scratched it.
My background and experience comes from Afghanistan and trying to understand the Taliban. And I just have this sense that there are so many things that we don't know. And every time I look into a subject, I realize actually we haven't really started to study the Taliban at all. And we know very little, whether it's in terms of the history, which I think is the thing we know least about, in part because the sources are so, there are so few good, useful sources, and it takes a lot of time, obviously, to create your own sources by interviewing people and so on. I haven't been working in the Middle East to the same extent, but I have some sense that there are a lot of gaps, and I just have a kind of a assumption or a hunch that that we're kind of at the same level there.
Yeah, I would say in terms of theology or jurisprudence, I think our understanding is pretty good. I wouldn't say it's perfect. It can always become more fine-grained, but I utterly agree with you that our understanding of the history of these organizations, you know, that are nominally adhering to the same ideology or similar ideologies, we don't have a good handle on at all. Partly that is a language barrier. It's not easy, as you know, to learn some of these languages that are required to get deep into it. And also because of how dangerous some of these groups are. It's
sure.
It's not easy to do a lot of original research on them. And also valuable sources are killed off,
yep,
as well.
Yep.
So it's not an easy area to work in. So I would agree with you in terms of histories of actual individuals and in groups, we are definitely at the starting stages.
Right.
At the end of the Brookings article, it ends with this cautionary note, which I liked, about, you know, worrying about creating the chaos that lets men like Baghdadi thrive or seize power or come to power. And in another one of your papers, you write about how perhaps the path we're on in terms of Western and American engagement of ISIS is maybe not fantastic, but it's in some ways quite realistic. What would you agree, or what do you think about the sense that have policy lessons, you know, kind of been absorbed and reflected on from the last decade, you know, coming out of the Middle East and in Central Asia? Sometimes it seems like we're reinventing the wheel, and other times it seems like, okay, maybe, you know, lessons have made its way up the chain. Would you say that, you know, there's been a reflection on specifically post-2001, post-2003 engagement with this part of the world, and that real policy changes have emerged as a result of that, which may kind of contain the chaos moving forward.
I would say among the policy-making elite, yes, there is much more of a pessimism about what the Americans can do in the Middle East, despite their overwhelming military power, and there's greater humility. It's tough to say with the political class, right?
Because our backdrop.
You don't know which of that to take seriously. In fact, I'm right now trying to catalog all the Republican candidates' positions on ISIS, and they are all over the field, actually. There's not a consistent view. Some of them can be isolationist. Some of them sound more aggressive, but when you scratch at it, they're just talking about putting a few more special forces on the ground. They're not talking about a big invasion. And I think everybody is really constrained by the mood of the American public, which is very much anti-interventionist. And even when there's spikes in their support for intervention, nobody believes it will be long-lasting. So it will not sustain a decades-long occupation. So I do think there has been a reassessment of the efficacy of American power, almost too far in the opposite extreme, right? There's almost a sense of hopelessness that the Americans just cannot do anything to help.
Can't do anything, right?
Right, which you know, will make it to where, if that endures, would make it to where that, you know, America would become increasingly isolationist, and you have other people, other powers who, you know, do not feel so helpless getting involved and perhaps making things even worse.
Just to switch gears, the listeners of our show will be familiar with the question which I'm about to ask. So, you know, you studied Arabic, and obviously to a high level, you've done translation work in it. You've used it as part of your ongoing work. Would you firstly say that it's something that has contributed kind of above and beyond in terms of skills that you've added to your quiver, and you know, as such, would you kind of counsel people to prioritize language learning if they're trying to go into whether it's research or kind of area studies or policy work?
I don't know if I would do it for policy work. I mean, certainly it helps, but I'm not snooty about these things. I think you can learn an awful lot about these organizations just by translations that are available, press reports. You know, you don't need to be a major scholar of the language to do that. And I would say, you know, if for people making decisions about their time, they would have to really evaluate what kind of job they hope to have in the future. That said, it has been a great use to me, obviously, both as a researcher, but also in the role of policymaking. Being able to go and check for a source, look at a translation, and then think, this word doesn't sound quite right. Is it as aggressive as it looks in the English? And then checking it against the original has been really useful. So I don't think you ever do yourself harm by learning another language, but as you both know, it is a huge, huge commitment of time. And, you know, I'm at the place in my career where my ability and time to learn new languages has just vanished.
Right.
And every time I pick up a new one, because you never quite get the bug out of your system, but when I pick up a new one now, that fad lasts for about a week. It just gets swept away by events.
What would you change about how you went about it the first time if you could do it all over again?
God, you know, so much has changed about Arabic instruction since I was in school. You know, when I started school, we were using the Orange Book. For any of you people that have been studying Arabic for a long time, it was the book produced by University of Texas at Austin. And this was well before the Al-Kitab series. Mm-hmm. So yes, you were learning, you know, eighth form feminine plurals before you were learning how to say hello. And it really screws you up.
Oh, that hasn't left Arabic tuition.
Sadly.
And I think it just, I think it really screws you up. In terms of, you know, your ability to really dive into the language, it can be quite intimidating. And I found Al-Kitab to be a refreshing step in the right direction. Persian language instruction, which I also study, is still terrible in this country. And I don't know anywhere else that's really figured it out either. I mean, it is awful. And it's a shame because that country eventually will open up, Iran.
Yep.
And, you know, we are going to have very few people who know the language well. We've got a lot of people studying Arabic, not as many studying Persian. And I hope, you know, there will be more attention given to improving that instruction. But Alex, like you, I really benefited a huge amount from going to Middlebury. No question.
Right.
I mean, the 9 weeks in Middlebury was vastly, vastly more important for my language acquisition than the whole year I did in Cairo.
Right.
That's great. Our last few questions, mindful of your time here, focus more on your routines. You know, in the last 4 years, at a quick glance, you've put together at least 2 books, several long-form essays, regular policy papers. You've worked in governments, or government. You're now over at Johns Hopkins. You know, Alex and I have talked a bit about this on the show prior, and we're curious to kind of prod each guest into opening up on how they work. You know, as just one question, do you have any specific writing routines that you follow when you're putting something either like this new Brookings publication together, or you know, closer to blog posts, or even to a book? You know, is it Microsoft Word and a lot of coffee, or is there another routine that you follow?
You know, I guess like. I know you guys are probably more organized than I am. I mean, it really depends on the job, right? And each new big job I start, I try to think through, okay, what is it about my process that I can improve here? For the ISIS book, interestingly, there wasn't a lot of systemization to the process. I mean, I thought about it in the beginning, but I really needed to get that book done. And it helped that I already knew the sources, right? And I had a general sense of what I wanted to say. So with that one was really just a process of diving in, right? And making sure I had essay length sections that I could work on as standalone sections, and then kind of just do all the reading around that section for a week and then synthesize it in 1,000 words, right? Mm-hmm. And so that's and some of the, you'll see in the books, a few of the sections were actually blog posts that I just forced myself to do the blog post as a way to put the material down and then refine it a little bit later. So I would say, you know, with in this one, I did not have a real systematic process for collecting things. And, you know, for the Quran book that I've been working on forever and which will never be finished, you know, there is a lot of system involved. I mean, I use Scrivener for that one, and it is chock full of folders and subfolders and references all over the place. But you know, that's because I know the subject matter I'm working on less, which is the late antique background of the Quran. So there is a ton of secondary source reading I have to do. And so that one by its nature requires a lot more organization. So I would say it depends on the task. In terms of writing routine, you know, usually if it's shorter pieces, I'm just fitting it in wherever I can. And thankfully, working at a place like Brookings, they give you the latitude to work at home or work in the office. You're primarily focused on writing most of the time, although I do have some managerial duties because I manage a program. But when I was working on the book, usually I would try and get at least 4 days a week that was that were going to be solid writing. You know, once the kids were off at school, you know, I could sit down at the computer. The first thing I did, and they always tell you this is the worst thing you can do. The first thing I did is I answered all of the emails I needed to
right.
for the morning, right? Like I worked through it. I got it all done because I knew I was going to turn off email, close down Twitter. Any distractions would be gone for the next 3 or 4 hours, right? And then I would resurface, answer emails around lunchtime, and then go back in until 3 or 4 in the afternoon when my brain was just melting down and I couldn't do anymore.
Mm-hmm. What's the Quran book and when could we look forward to that? You know, if it's never finished, when can we get a draft?
Man, I am not exaggerating on that one. That thing will never be done. I was in the middle of, I mean, this is like the first two sentences of the ISIS book explaining that, you know, I'm supposed to be writing a Quran book right now. And then the takeover of Mosul happened and I got nonstop press queries about it. And it was totally distracting me from the Quran book. I was like, screw it. I'm just going to write an ISIS book because it's all I'm right. doing anyway. And I feel like the pace of events is such that I don't know when I'm ever going to have the time to sit back and write a really carefully considered study of early Islamic history, just by virtue of where I sit. I mean, Brookings is happy to let me do it. But when you're at a think tank, you know, the cultural pressure, not direct pressure, but the cultural pressure is such that, you know, you need to be doing relevant work. And it's not always sure. relevant to be thinking about, you know, where did the Quran come from as a scripture, which is the subject of the book.
Mm-hmm. One last question for you here. You mentioned how you will close Twitter, close out email, and kind of shut out the world. What about when you're trying to learn about the world, when you're kind of without regret diving into Twitter and the information flood, right. so to speak, and trying to track so many different sources, ISIS among others? How do you keep track of it all?
Well, I guess like most people, I use Evernote. I mean, I found that to mm-hmm. be really, really handy just to preserve things, because you study something like ISIS, most of those Twitter accounts were taken away.
Right.
I mean, they were gone within weeks of me looking at them. And thankfully, I saved most of them.
Yeah.
But these sources are very ephemeral, even though they're online. But mm-hmm. and this is also the case, I know you guys know, but this is also the case for like Arabic language sources on news sites, right?
Yeah.
Because
yeah.
the news sites, like some of these are really transient news enterprises that don't last beyond a year or so. So you've really got to also save those as well. So Evernote was a huge help just in terms of keeping a digital footprint of where I had traveled.
Will, thank you so much for taking the time to talk with us on the first episode of our new season. We really appreciate it.
Oh, it's my pleasure. Thank you for having me.
For our listeners, if you heard a reference to something, a book or a website or an article, the full show notes with links to everything we talked about in the show can be found at sourcesandmethods.com. If you enjoyed what you heard this week and in previous episodes, please consider writing a review of the show in iTunes or on Twitter or in real life. Thanks for listening.